There have been people who have been saying lessons are going to be open. I'm going to go and reflect the whole time. I'm going to place myself in the queue of the government.
That other people did not experience the same thing in the future. And last year I also indicated that I want to ensure that we balance rigor or thoroughness with swiftness. Further down the line, it would be interesting to reflect together with the committee on how far has my team and I traveled in ensuring accessibility, recourse to the individual, and acting as catalyst for transforming to ensure that the system consistently gets things right. Our constitutional mandate is the following, Honourable Chair, and members. Section 182 of the Constitution provides that the public protector has the power, as regulated by national legislation, to A. Investigate any conduct in state affairs or in the public administration in any sphere of government that is alleged or suspected to be improper or to result in any impropriety or prejudice. I understand our mandate to cover the entire state, insofar as state affairs is concerned, and I understand our money to be covering the public service, the public administration sector as a whole, not just the public service, and understand the mandate to extend to any sphere of government, which would be regional, provincial, and local government. B. Report on the conduct, and C. Take appropriate legal action. Subsection 2 states that the public protector has the additional powers and functions prescribed by national legislation. And subsection 3 says the public protector may not investigate court decisions. Subsection 4 says the public protector must be accessible to all persons and communities. And subsection 5 says the report issued by the public protector must be open to the public unless exceptional circumstances to be determined in terms of national legislation require that the report be kept confidential. Section 182 is to be read with Section 182 establishing the public protector to support and strengthen constitutional democracy. I have read the mandate because there's often confusion around what really is what we're doing. I don't have read it as it is. I will not discuss what our understanding is because you will note that towards the end of our presentation, we make a request to go back to the mandate. Our starting target mandates are vast. You have noticed that Subsection 2 says the public protector has additional powers and functions prescribed by national legislation. All I would like to mention, not necessarily for the purpose of this parliament, but for the purpose of organs of state that we deal with, our powers derive from the Constitution and not from statute. Our statutory mandates are additional to our constitutional mandate. We often get people coming and saying, oh, but the Public Protector Act does not allow you to do that. The Public Protector Act cannot reduce the mandate that is given by anyone by the Constitution. We have 6 key statutory mandates. All in all, there's about 16 mandates that we have that have been dealt by statute. But from those, we've isolated 6 on the roll. The first and main mandate is non-administration mandate under the Public Protector Act No. 23 of 1984. This mandate includes abuse or unjustifiable exercise of power, capricious, discourteous conduct, improper or unlawful enrichment or receipt of any advantage, and omissions that result in improper prejudice. I must indicate that this mandate also includes our anti-corruption mandate, because when you read the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, for it to make sense regarding what the mandate of the Crown Protector is, we've got to read that act together with 36 of the Crown Protector. Section 8 of the Public Protector Act may give me the power to make findings or to make suggestions, to make findings. In other countries they call it a determination. The Ombudsman makes a determination, and most European countries then would separate the determination from remedial action. In other words, you have a power to make a finding. That's your statutory power. But then you're given discretion on how to remedy the situation. Our second key statutory mandate is enforcement of effective ethics code. And this mandate comes from the Executive Members Ethics Act. So we have the power to enforce Executive Ethics Code in terms of the Executive Members Ethics Act. And we have the power to enforce other ethics. Other ethical lapses are something that we can also deal with, but not under the Executive Members Ethics Act, but under the Public Protector Act. Our third mandate is the enforcement of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. As I indicated earlier, this has to be read together with Section 6 of the Public Protector Act, and this is a shared mandate. Our fourth mandate is for a safe harbor within our for whistleblowers under the Protective Disclosures Act, number 26 of 2000. And we then also have the power to resolve disputes or to review the decisions of the National Home Builders Registration Council. We then also have, lastly, the power to resolve access to information disputes under the Protection of Access to Information Act. Honourable members, I thought I should engage you very briefly also about our purpose as an organisation. You may recall that last year I indicated to this committee that we had started a process that was around leadership building, team building, but also to focus us on the people, to make sure that everything that we did was informed by a purpose as opposed to just being administrative. We asked ourselves that the Constitution says we investigate, we report, we take appropriate remedial action. But we have to ask ourselves, to what purpose? Why would we investigate, report, and take appropriate remedial action? I must indicate, honourable members, that what you're seeing in front of you is a document, is a statement that was not created by me, and I'm proud of the fact that that came from the team. Because of time constraints, I was not able to attend the higher people's workshops, and I attended the last one, and when they had to finalize the higher people's statement, again, I had to be called to duty, and I came back, they had finalized the higher people's statement. But I'm very proud of the higher people's statement, and I resonate with it. The team has decided that we exist as a conscience of the state to act with integrity and fairness. You would say, why not the conscience? we were very careful not to call ourselves being conscious, because those states have many consciences, and we could not appropriate ourselves the space of being the only conscious of the state. And we don't think it was the constitution drafters to make us the only conscious of the state. But the key words they are about conscience, which is to pick the state, to think differently about how to conduct business, particularly how to treat people and people's resources, to ensure that the state acts with integrity at all times, and that above everything else, there's a number of things, to ensure that the state is there, which is what an ombudsman is supposed to do. Honourable members, I thought again I should repeat a statement that I had read to this committee before, and that statement says the following. Even the most benevolent of governments are made up of people with all the propensities for human failings. The rule of law is, as we understand it, consists in the set of conventions and arrangements that ensure that it is not left to the whims of individual rulers to decide on what is good for the populace. The administrative conduct of governments and authorities are subject to the scrutiny of independent authors. An essential part of that constitutional architecture is those state institutions supporting constitutional democracy. Among those are the Parks Project, the Human Rights Commission, the Auditor General, the Independent Electoral Commission, the Commission on Gender Equality, the Commission on Food and Assets, and Constitution. Honourable members, I also included for your benefit what we regard as the year 2012-1981. This Parliament gave us a budget allocation of 183,626 rand. I must just indicate that some of it was only received in October towards the end of the year, so we were not able to utilize it meaningfully. However, we were grateful for that. We operated in the year under review with a staff complement of 284,000 staff members, and you will recall, honourable members, that we are responsible for oversight over 1,000 organs of state. And when I'm talking organs of state, I'm talking primarily looking at departments. But within a department, if you take, for example, the Department of Health, it would have more than 1,000 health centers in the country on its own. If you take the Department of Education, my understanding is that the Department of Education has 21,000 schools, meaning anyone can submit a request for an investigation on any given school. Of course, we would deal with the education authorities and try and see if they could resolve it internally before we get involved. But that means we have oversight over all those bodies with 284 people. The number of cases that we handled during the year under review, honourable members, is 37,770. And the number of cases that we initiated anew or were based on received complaints were 26,860. And of the cases that we received, the 25,000 that we got, we referred to other institutions or back to the organs of state involved, 2,085 cases. We then handled from our side 22,400 cases that we finalized. Of the 22,400 cases that we finalized, we believe that our productivity increased by 5,600 cases, which is the difference between what we finalized in the year under this review and the previous year. Sadly, we carried over 13,995 cases. Some of them were received shortly before we closed our book. Some of them, it was due to the problems that we had with our capacity. We issued only 24 reports, which is a decline in the number of reports. It's not a decline that this government should necessarily be too worried about, because when we were involved in an investigation and we had a draft report, if the organ of faith solved the problem and we didn't think it was a systemic problem that needed to be reported on, we would close the investigation and not write a report. That speaks to the extent to which we have gravitated towards ACR to make sure that there is a remedy that people's lives can be impacted by. We conducted 4 media briefings. We reached about 51,347 persons. In the report on the members, it is explained how the number is constituted. It doesn't mean that the number of we therefore met every South African, including newborn babies. It just means that some of the people that we reached more than once, due to the fact that we reached them through various media, such as TV, radio, newspapers, and then some of them we have direct contact through our outreach initiative. We upheld about half of the complaints that we referred to us, which is 49%, and we conducted 893 outreach claims. We thought you should also just note a few events that we held as part of ensuring that we became more accessible to the people of South Africa, but also we deepened the conversation around good governance. The key event was our national stakeholder dialogue between July and August last year, and then our good governance week between the 15th of October and the 20th of October in the same year. Internally, we have a continuous process that we call learning and growing together. It involves internal conversations about how we do business. It also involves training ourselves for various matters. There was training in May on complaint handling and human rights. Some members of the Public Protector team were subjected to training in that is referred to as advanced certificate in fraud examination. 19 investigators are now qualified fraud examiners. What are some of the recurring themes from the investigations that we do? The recurring themes. To start with a recurring theme, which is a failure. In my report, I indicated that service failure is from indifference to systemic service failure. Honourable members, I have already engaged you previously on the theme around indifference. It was the main theme that I engaged you on in April. Honourable members, when I engaged you in April, I gave an emphasis on the issue of indifference, and I indicated that most of the concerns that come to us involve systemic service failure. They involve indifference, which ultimately leads to systemic service failure. What is indifference? Indifference happens when somebody comes for service and the person helping them really doesn't really care. It could be a duplicate ID letter that takes 5 years to resolve, it could be a person who comes and says that I have been declared dead but I'm alive, and it takes another 5 years to do that. It's a major problem. Then part of the difference is when people apply for a service or a review of a service and their letter is not adjudicated for a long, long time. We also engaged you, honourable members, when we met with you in April about systemic service failure. And examples of systemic service failure, we gave you such as problems with the poor planning of things like RDP housing, when there's deviation from IDPs, and generally there is no following of proper procedures, leading to a systems collapse. And we gave examples of some of the matters that we've dealt with. An example being Nala, where the system almost collapsed because there was repeated failure to comply with the system. And when people failed to comply, it was discovered that they failed to comply, there was impunity. In Nala, there was even a case where after a forensic audit was ordered, the results were not implemented. Those are the examples that we brought to your attention. In the report, we have given a more elaborate narrative. Conduct failure, we say, is from non-compliance to corruption. In between from non-compliance and corruption, honorable members, there are problems such as overbilling, overcharging, tender rigging, and lastly, there's a new phenomenon that we've picked up, which is called scope creep, where a project starts and initially it was going to cost 2 million. We are told actually people deliver it under quote. But by the time the project is finished, it's costing 2 billion. We can engage with the committee on what are some of the findings we've made around scope creep. We are in the process of finalizing several investigations where that problem is appearing to be growing rather than narrowing. And our members, lastly, how accessible have we become? We believe that we've become more accessible primarily through our outreach initiatives. We can't become any more accessible through physical presence because of budgetary constraints, understandably so. We spoke to this committee about our footprint, and the committee indicated that in the current fiscal situation in the country and the world, it wouldn't make sense to be given an elaborate budget to create more new offices. And we did heed that advice from the committee. And whilst we thought we needed to create a few more offices, our emphasis shifted towards having more mobile offices and other outreach initiatives, and then having agency agreements with organizations such as the post office. We've already met with the post office, and the post office is amenable to the idea of becoming our agent. It is now just a question of finalizing our memorandum of understanding. We hope that by now we have finalized that memorandum of understanding. Honorable members, just a note on the RDP investigation. As we briefed you in April, we are conducting a systemic investigation into RDP housing. We've been doing so since last year, 2012, after receiving a flood of complaints on RDP housing maladministration. We then included public hearings on these RDP hearings. we included public hearings on RPP housing in our stakeholder consultation 2012. It was about really hitting two beds with one stone, and it worked very well because it gave us more people. It gave an opportunity for more people to engage with us, but at the same time, it actually allowed us to solve some of those problems without going into investigation, because during the public hearings, we brought all of the key role players to the party, such as mayors, minister, managers, councillors, and the community at large. And some of the complaints that were raised were immediately solved by the role players. We have received hundreds of complaints, thousands really of complaints at the public hearings. And what we have picked up as key fault lines are some of the following. It's really maladministration in the area of planning, procurement, allocation, and post-allocation practices, including the provision of title deeds and resale of those houses. We can engage if there are any questions around the RDP housing, but we've provided our preliminary report on that matter for your information. It's not necessarily for discussion today. We had a very fruitful engagement with the Portfolio Committee on Human Settlements on the 20th of February this year. We presented the full report on RDP housing, and the committee undertook to integrate the observations we made in its day-to-day oversight work. We also engaged with the Cabinet on the 24th of October 2012 last year. And Cabinet was briefed on all our preliminary observations on RDP housing. Really, my request and the request of the Park Protector team generally was that we shouldn't be experiencing the same problems going forward. We have learned lessons from 1996 to where we are. We shouldn't still be getting people who have been given keys to their homes with such homes that defective. We shouldn't still be getting houses being allocated to people who do not qualify for RPP housing while the owners of those houses are not getting those houses. Basically, we shouldn't be getting new complaints. We should be fixing the old ones and then moving forward. Thirdly, though, we are getting new complaints that are based on new houses that have been allocated after the RDP housing public hearing, and have engaged with the role players in premiers and legislatures this year and indicated that it really is an indictment on all of us if those problems continue, because it would mean that our intervention has not paid dividends. But from their side also, it would mean that they are continuing to waste time and money. And they have agreed with me that we shouldn't be getting this new problem. And one province went house to house, literally counting the houses, to make sure that we don't get a contractor that says they built 200 houses when they only built 130. And they also went and just walked check on the quality of the houses. Some provinces have not really done much, other than obviously administratively tightening things, but it seems like some of the things are still falling through the cracks. From our side, we're proceeding with finalizing the formal investigation, and we still hope that we should be able to conclude it, or at least a provisional report, by the end of this year. We have also now commenced another systemic investigation into health. Already we were doing a systemic investigation on child mortality, and a pilot of this was concluded in the Free State. We also asked to look at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, and as we were busy with those two, there was a flood of complaints around general management. We were mindful, though, that the Department of Health has a very elaborate program under the NHI that seeks to improve not just the flow of money in hospitals, but the quality of management and quality of services. As a result, we asked the Department of Health to partner with us and make sure that as we went around the country, we are accompanied by a senior member of the department that would explain certain things, but also make certain observations so that those observations may be integrated in the work that is already being done by the department. We held the public hearings between July and September 2013. We had fruitful report accessions with all provincial legislatures, and the provincial legislatures that we had fruitful meetings with are Eastern Cape, KZN, Northern Cape, Western Cape, Mpumalanga, Gauteng, Limpopo. Yes, and Limpopo. We haven't much had an opportunity to engage with the legislature of the Northwest, and hopefully we will be able to engage with them. And then with Gauteng, we didn't engage with the entire legislature. We only engaged with the chairperson of committees, but that was good on its own. And those were again fruitful because some of the report back observations we shared with them, it turns out that some of them had also done spot checks on some of the health facilities and came back with similar conclusions. We have then given them draft reports so that those could be integrated in their day-to-day oversight work, and then they could proceed to handle the easy matters. The idea being that our systemic investigation will only deal with maladministration issues, not the small issues that could be dealt with, given that all parties conceded that those were problems. Honourable members, progress on the public protector rules. The public protector rules have been finalised from our part and adopted by EXCO in my office. We will then be submitting them to state advisors for gazetting purposes, and we will also bring them then to Parliament or to this committee for a final discussion before I issue them as given the law by the Public. I will now hand over to the Chief Executive Officer in my office to talk very briefly about resources that are given to us by Parliament and how we have used those resources to pursue our constitutional and statutory mandate.
Thank you, Public Protector, and Chairperson, or our members, colleagues, and the media. As you can note from the slide, members, our workload has increased just from under 30,000 in the past financial year to just over 37,000 this financial year that we are reporting, as indicated in the green slide, in the green folder that is reflected on the slide. As you can see, that has been a stride if you look at the previous and the financial year from 2010 to 2011, 2011 to 2012, and then 2012 to 2013. This is the reflection of the case workload for the 2012-2013 on the chair and members, based on our core function and national office, which is based at core units, engaged in resolution, good governance, and service and delivery. If we combine it with the provincial offices that we also manage, you will notice that we have over 13,000, just under 14,000 cases that we have carried over to this financial year. This is the workload of the investigator at a national office. You will notice that we're just 40 investigators, and the case load is 893. Chairperson, the ideal situation on complex matters that we basically handle at the national office is about 6 to 9 cases. Some cases to about 3 cases. So the average of 203 cases per investigator is quite high. The early resolution matters, as well, the ideal situation is 15 to 25 cases per month, but the cases that are currently handling at a rate of 200 investigators is quite high. with then a vacant rate of 3.7%, which is currently far under the norm, the national norm in government. But what is of concern, Chairperson, is that there are 556 positions in the structure. 261 of those are unfunded, which basically represent that we are 47% under resourced, which is a concern based on the increase of the workload that we need to see the motivation that we would like to get support in terms of getting the structure funded. This is the annual budget and the public worker indicated very increase in terms of the expenditure, 189 million and the House of Representatives for an approved budget. In terms of the audit report, we've got of course an unqualified vote for opinion with a matter of emphasis. One is having the case management system and supply chain with the issue of the test current certificate of which we have been addressing. As we may see from the note 29 in the annual report, there was a misstatement as a result of the figure that we have covered, a compilation of the annual report which has been correct. We also had issues in respect of the list we were not previously recorded, which was corrected and increased that accumulated surplus by about 5 million. To this end, we have come up with an action plan to address this findings. I may say, Chairperson, members, that out of the targets that we set for ourselves, we achieved 76% of those targets. The 24% that we did not achieve were in fact as a result of the bar which the public protector set in terms of the turnaround times and that was set for us, which in fact has been currently engaging in the union because they felt that the targets were set to be high. But the view that the executive has adopted is that obviously we should keep the promises we've made to the people of South Africa as possible. In terms of the turnaround time. So basically, that 24% of the targets not achieved were relating to those and of course the issue of the case management. We have been asking for more in terms of the feedback of our structure with from this perspective as well. We definitely ask to get some more support and motivation for the committee for more funds as well. In terms of those targets that that is not achieved, that covers about 24%, there's been a constant engagement with the staff and the public protector and the human I've touched on this related to the tax clearance certificate. And of course, I've presented the action plan and to address some of these audit findings. Most of those were in the 80% time, 10% time, and of course, the question with the 80% of respect to the case management, which is kept to 2007 and 2008 financially.
Thank you, CEO, and thank you, Honorable. Honorable Chairperson, just in terms of the Chief Executive Officer is already indicated that we don't have the funds and that the resources that we have are not commensurate with the mandate and strategic objectives. Of course, you would say that our strategic objectives are set by ourselves, and you would be saying when you say that. We really have difficulty around the timeline. We have been advised that they should consider extending the timeline. And we've done that with our ER rate, we've said that the timeline could be longer. It's still not very fair to people because there are cases where if you resolve the letter in 6 months' time, it's too late really for the person. But we have extended it. Our ER timeline used to be 3 months. We have extended them to 6 months. The CEO is talking about a discussion we had because investigators did not want to sign their performance agreement, saying that the timelines are impossible. Not the ER ones, it's the ones that are doing normal investigations. At the moment, those investigations are 12 months. With the current resources, 12 months is impossible. Because if you are carrying good governance and integrity investigations and you're getting 50 to 75 files, then somebody says each one of those had to be concluded within 12 months. It is not possible. In all fairness, the ones that are carrying this complex good governance and integrity investigations can possibly complete 6 investigations a year. That is what I think. I must indicate, though, that we employed trainee investigators this year with the advice of the Auditor General as a colleague. We created a new layer of people called trainee investigators, and it made a tremendous difference. But the sad thing is that we are losing them as fast as we get them. At the last count, we've lost almost 40% of them, and it wasn't 6 months yet. Because these are young lawyers, highly skilled, but just trying to find a place for themselves. And what we're offering them is a little too little for them, because some of them have taken batteries, loans to study, and some of them need money for accommodation and things like that. Part of our request for funding will be also looking at increasing the amount that we're paying to those trainees. The key priorities we were requesting immediate attention from this government on our choices and other points, the budgetary constraints that I've indicated. In our discussion during the strategic plan, we became a little bit distracted. I'm recommending now on our choices that if it's possible that this committee could appoint 2 people from this committee and a technical support person from the Speaker's office, the new office institutions supporting the model. If we can have 1 member from the governing party and 1 member representing the opposition parties come and maybe spend some time in the office and then just look at the report and have some kind of fair assessment of the cases. And I wanted this time that we should focus on the complex investigations because we got distracted by the air resolution matters the last time. That is my request because somehow we need to make a more scientific assessment on what the office declares. I was looking back at the interaction I had with this parliament in 2010. The parliament had approved the structure and had agreed that we needed additional resources. But last year we had a slightly different take on it, and then this year again when we presented our strategic plan, there wasn't full consensus on what additional resources we need. I'm just making that suggestion. It's up to the committee and probably parliament as a whole on how do we move forward on the issue of adequate resources for this office. I believe that we do need additional resources, probably double the number of people that we have. We need support on OSD, which is occupational specific dispensation, and then on the expansion of the footprint. This is how the conservative estimate of the additional resources looks like. You will see the honourable members that we are looking at upgrading the salaries of existing personnel. It has become a big issue. The OSD level that people were placed on was not commensurate with the responsibility that each investigator has. We have also had the other grouping for requesting upgrading outreach officers, admin officers, secretaries. We are also requesting, for that upgrade, we are requesting 3.2 million, and then for the OSP was requesting 11.5 million. And then the organogram that was approved by this parliament last time, which then went to DPSA and the Minister of Finance, who also approved it, that they do not have additional funding now. We are requesting an additional 17 million or so for that. That brings the amount to about 31 million. What lessons have you learned in the year? There has been an increase in the number and complexity of complaints that this office has received. That indicated the trend is that at the level of the individual, it is people not adjudicating a request or what we refer to as indifference. And then systemic service failure in some of the municipalities. At the level of conduct failure, it's just a lack of compliance leading to things such as overcharging, overbilling, tender rigging, and corruption. Those cases are very complex in nature. They can't be dealt with by one investigator. So increasingly we are using teams to investigate. But that means one investigator will be pulled away from their own lot to provide resources to a investigation. From our side, we think the productivity levels have increased. As I've indicated, that we moved from having completed less than 20,000 cases in the previous year, and then this year about more than 22,000 cases were concluded. And the increase there was 5,600 cases. We are constantly trying to balance swiftness and accuracy. It is a requirement of justice that we should both be swift and accurate. That substantive justice and ensuring that justice is delivered on time. But it is a constant difficult enterprise to try and find civility. From our side, we're constantly improving skills and improving work methods. Virtually every month, we're looking at how can we do things differently so that we can do more with less. So that for us is an ongoing competition. And holding hands with municipalities, provinces, and affected departments has improved. The stakeholder consultative process was very helpful in that some of the complaints that we received today were resolved on the spot, and some were resolved subsequent to that because they were undertaken to resolve them. That is what we call direct contact, which is improving our team at this time. But there are a few implementation concerns. Most departments have implemented the 24 reports that we issued, most of them were implemented. There's only one report where there was difficulty, but the department concerned didn't say it was not going to implement. The department concerned had some difficulties around avoiding the floodgates. And we've had several engagements with the accounting officer in that department. And we both agreed that something has to be done, there was an injustice. The question is around how do you do it in such a way that there is no opening of the floodgate and there's a justification to the outage. The lessons we've learned from all our oversight work. I've indicated to Honourable Chairperson and members that we've observed that there are systemic administrative deficiencies, mostly relating to lapses in compliance. At the level of service data, I have indicated that we would like the Parliament to look at the issue of indifference. Previously indicated that when people abuse money, we make sure that they are accountable for it. We have to make sure that people are accountable for abusing fellow human beings as well. FTT is an example of where there's been systemic service data, administration of the state and municipal services. But there are improvements on the numbers. If you look at SASA, the issue that we raised previously with SASA are constantly being dealt with, or there are new areas where there are problems. but the problems are not as systemic as they used to be. IP concerns, most of the IP concerns have been resolved, and we have a very good working relationship with Home Office. The only problem is this persistent problem of duplicate IPs, which you probably will recall that the Minister of Home Affairs and myself had did an agreement around 2010 on how to end this problem, but it persists with dire consequences for affected people and serious implications for poverty. There are growing reports of corruption and tender rigging. If we don't end impunity, no difference will be made on the issues around corruption and tender rigging. We have picked up that local government is a problem not only because of human behavior, but also policy gaps in some of the municipalities. In one of the reports, we indicated that we are going to ask SALGA to assist with a policy toolkit so that the municipalities can use that and then just adapt it to their settings. We have requested government to tighten the ethics regulatory framework, and we have also requested that there be training on ethics, so that there's a common understanding again on what is ethical and what is not. And in this regard, we must thank the portfolio committee or the joint committee on ethics for involving us in the conversation about ethics. We also observe that there is no consistency sometimes in the application of the disciplinary action than legal to in future. And that's something that we're asking that all public entities be aware of and take action to deal with. The specific report is that for additional funding is 35,389,000. Thank you. At least that's the way forward. At least we're negotiating starting 35,000. We'll just become more. And then in the future, that may be convenient to the committee and us. We need to engage on a discussion around Section 182 of the Constitution, which is the part of the Constitution that gives this office power. This recommendation I made after I had engaged with the Portfolio Committee on Public Accounts and realized how the Audit General and the committee work. There have been engagements around the common vision on what really is the right way to do business. So when it comes to enforcement, there aren't differences in approaches because those things would have been resolved in some kind of dialogue between the parties. So we would like us to have some kind of flexible, just think tank kind of dialogue where we just talk about these understandings and then try to streamline understanding. And then hopefully when it comes then to the oversight work, we won't be talking about when to red card and when not to red card, because that would have been communication. We would like support where they say that to implement legal action. We don't have a case to go to Parliament yet because the two difficult cases that we had, it's been negotiations. It's not been somebody who says, I will not implement. It's them just saying, please clarify this. This is going to create difficulties. We had one municipality where it was a difficulty, but the premier in that particular province has decided to take responsibility for it together with the MEC or local government. In that regard, I don't have any case that I would like to present specifically to the committee or parliament to assist to enforce the presentation. We would like to that our secretaries should organize a meeting so that we can finalize the rules. And then lastly, we requested Parliament as a whole to support IONA and IOA pivoters. We are the secretaries of the African Ombudsman and Mediators Association. You will see in a report that we have detailed what we have done under the association. As part of IONA's support, we have created a center in Durban, which is called the African Ombudsman Research Center. This venture is funded by DECO through the African Development Fund, and we thank the DECO or the Department of International Relations and Cooperation for this. There are several activities that have been undertaken in that regard, mostly research around the Ombudsman Institution in Africa and the world, with a view to strengthening the effectiveness of this institution in this continent as part of solutions to good governance in the continent. We'll be having a summit here in Cape Town in December, which will be just looking again at research issues around the African Ombudsman and how to support the institution under the IOK activities, and we're asking you to note that and to support that. And lastly, just to thank you for the support and for this opportunity to engage. We have engaged, and we believe that we may not always agree, and that is human, which we always agree, but based on the things that you raised with us, we've been able to reflect, and as we reflect, we kept doing things differently, and that is good for the progress that we're making in the office. We would like to thank the Portfolio Committee on Ethics for the support that we've received from that committee and involvement in its activities, and also joint operations where appropriate. We'd like to thank the Portfolio Committee on Human Settlements for the reception that we got when we presented the report on RDP housing. We'd like to thank the Speaker's Office for continuous support in everything that we do, and the presiding offices, all four of them, for the support we've received and the listening ear whenever we have requested support. We would also like to thank the people of South Africa for continuously engaging with this office, indicating what their needs are and supporting us as we try to meet those needs. To thank our Senator institutions, particularly the Auditor General, for the guidance when it comes to the issues of managing our own resources, and the organs of state themselves, particularly those that make our work easier. But lastly, just to thank the public protector team, starting with the Deputy Public Protector, Advocate Malunga, the Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Petra, and the branches, the aides of branches. My deeper gratitude goes to the food soldiers who take their job as if it was a calling, and they go beyond the call duty. Yesterday, a team came to me and I was rushing, wanting to go out of my office. They wouldn't let me because they wanted to attend me to attend to a matter. And it was an employment matter, and it was somebody whose salary has been stopped abruptly without following any procedure. And that person was in hospital when the salary was stopped. And that person ended up without any money, without money for food, without money for medicine. And the team that was approaching me yesterday had to buy baby formula for the complainant. And that is what I call going into the college. Siyabonga, Realebowa, thank you. We hope that in our small way we are contributing to a stage that is more thoughtful, a stage that operates with more integrity, and more than anything else, a stage that is served to its people. I'd like to end with the following quotation from Margaret Mead. As our quotation, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has killed the future.
Thank you, Ms. Moranza. Any more members' comments and questions? Dr. Smuts, Dr. Mocheka, Mrs. Schaefer, Mrs. Swart, Simone.
Public Protector, you began very elegantly by quoting the poem about going to the fork in the road and taking the road less traveled. I remind you of what the great Yogi Berra baseball coach said: when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Now, one of the forks in the road for you is your adverse findings by the Auditor General. Can we look at those again, please? You have, for the first time, a finding against you in respect of the procurement process. And I'm sure that I don't have to say to you that it's unfortunate when your office has such findings, when you are finding against other people. For example, Exhibit A in your annual report is Helen Zilla for problems, poor demand management with the procurement process. And I mean, for her trouble, she has her face run in newspapers with a caption underneath Zell administration. Now, you have done what looks to be remarkably similar things. And therefore, I mean, that can't just be a lot to us. The Auditor General undertook to come back to us on exact details of what went wrong. The CEO very passingly referred to them, but perhaps it's only right that we dwell on that a little bit. Then the other thing, you wanted the $5 million, but the Auditor General said that the reason why you missed 25% of your targets is not what you told us. Everybody else tells us they set their targets too high, therefore they missed their targets, therefore the Auditor General tells them, lower your targets. Seems to me a crazy way to run things, but there you are. You've missed 25% of your targets, more in fact. Now, the Auditor General says this was due to targets not being suitably developed during the strategic planning process. So the answer isn't always just more money. If you're not developing your targets during the planning process, if the achievement of your targets is not monitored continuously throughout the year, then the answer is not simply just to give you $35 million. So I think we need a little more information on that. But particularly what I really want to get to, and perhaps it can't be exhausted today, is I welcome your request for a discussion. I do think it's in your case necessary. On, it is essentially about your scope of your file. But I want to first now to ask you, on your, practically your first slide, you quote at length from Dame Julie Mellor, in a quotation that is exactly inapposite in your case. You quote the chairman of the Public Administration Committee in the UK saying, you are statutorily forbidden from discussing individual cases. And I thought it would be helpful if we reminded ourselves of why are you quoting this? I mean, Section 92 of your Act, by contrast, says that nothing contained in this Act shall prohibit the discussion in Parliament of a matter being investigated or which has been investigated by the public protector. You know that. I know that. So why give us this quote? We can discuss matters. Let me say right now that I have no intention of alluding to the matter that is now before another committee of this House under the esteemed chairmanship of this chairman. I'm sure no other member intends to. That's a different matter. But of course we can discuss matters you are investigating. We do so routinely with the Human Rights Commission. We had a wonderful session again last week where we challenged them on certain choices of investigations or matters that they take. They don't have a problem with that. They said it's something they've been worrying about themselves. I told them they're not the guerrilla of South Africa. There's a non-existent line between looking at alleged hurtfulness and censorship. And we all enjoyed the discussion. That is the normal way of working between us and the chapter 9 that report to us. So, I mean, some of the discussion is very short. The answer is very simple. You, interpreter, are responsible to us. Accountability is a hierarchical relationship. You must justify your performance of your function to us. It's really actually quite simple. But the fact that I would enjoy a bit of a discussion on is the following. You've pointed to us Section 182, that's what you want to discuss. Now, Section 182 says that you have a power as regulated by legislation to investigate. Now, here's the important part, which I would love your response on. To investigate any conduct in state affairs or in the public administration in any sphere of government that is alleged to be improper resulted in prior imprisonment and therefore. The public administration is that stuff in chapter 10. It is the civil service. Right? It's public service. What is your definition of state affairs? Because everything I think revolves around this. How do you read conduct in state affairs? Have you taken legal opinion in the course of your thinking? Because you're now 4 years into a 7-year job, and yet here we are every year still discussing the scope of your funds. We don't have the same problem with comparable institutions. I would like to know your definition of state affairs, and I'll tell you why. I think it is, with respect, absolutely bizarre that you have intruded upon the work of a committee of this parliament. It's not this one, it's another committee. Its chairman is not here, and I hesitate to discuss it too much in his absence. I find it absolutely bizarre that you write to the executive to say that a committee of parliament is taking too long to decide on what happens to be an incredibly complicated issue. Would you like to remark on that? This is the National Assembly. The National Assembly consists of the 400 MPs. Each committee is an organ of those 400 MPs. We have certain powers. The Speaker, by the way, is simply an officer of the National Assembly. He's not our boss. The executive, by the way, the ministers, are not our boss. They account to us in many respects. So how is it possible that you could intrude on the work of the Committee of Parliament? I find it unbelievable. And I'm really sorry that the chairman isn't here. But the reason I want you to answer is, what is your idea of the conduct in state affairs? And I will await the answer and the legal definition. But surely, we're talking mostly about the executive at the various spheres of government, not the independent emanations of the state, of which the National Assembly, to which you account, is one. That is, we are an independent emanation of the state. So on the chapter 9, which are independent of government, outside of government. Surely all of us who are the institutions outside government have a natural, symbiotic, mutually supportive role. But you will give me your interpretation, please, and your definitions of what conduct in state affairs is. I think it's bizarre that you intrude on the work of a committee of government.
Chairperson, let me thank the Public Protector and his team for having prepared very well for this session and also providing us with all the documentation. As a new member of this committee, I'm actually taken aback to hear from the Public Protector that there is still confusion on what the office is supposed to be doing. And I am also amazed to hear that we still need to have a conversation or discussion about it. Because I thought that about 20 years into our democracy, we understand our constitution and we are at a point of implementing the constitution. But from those remarks, it appears that we haven't yet gotten to understand the constitution. Now, there are four issues that I would raise in that regard, and one has already been raised. What is the meaning of the state and the state affairs? And what is the meaning of higher purpose? Is the public protector the conscience of the state or the people? What is the difference between the state and the people? And this question relates as well to the resources that are required. Because if we are not clear on the mandate, then we are going to have problems with the resources that we need, because the mandate may be narrow and require little resources, or maybe so broad that it requires all the resources of the state. Now, I thought that in fact there are governing principles within the Constitution that should assist all of us. Apparently they have not assisted. One, it is saying that this office must strengthen the constitutional democracy. In my view, when you strengthen something, you don't substitute it. But if you strengthen to the extent that you may take over the functions of other institutions, then your mandate will be broader than what the Constitution envisages. But also, the other principle is that this body must be independent, and that is important, that you act without fear, favor, or prejudice, and I think that is what you are doing. It's also another principle is that there must be no interference with your work, and I am happy that this parliament and these committees are not interfering with my work. And also that you are entitled to assistance by other organs of the state through legislation and other measurements. I'm not quite sure if you have been well assisted in this regard, because if you were well assisted, we would be having a common understanding of what the Constitution means and what the scope of your work is. The other point made, which is very important, is that you are accountable to this parliament through this committee, and that means therefore that you have to justify your definition of the scope of your work, and also you know justify the resources that you require for your work. Because already the amount that you require may be justifiable, but if the scope is not agreed to, or the scope may be wider than what the Constitution requires, then there's a problem. How do we then, at this committee, come to the conclusion that the amount is justifiable or not? Which means that the question of the scope of your mandate has got to be settled before the amount you require to determine. But you also said something that puzzled me a little bit when you said that you derive your authority or your power from the Constitution and not from legislation. My reading of the Constitution is that the Constitution indeed gives you power, but the Constitution empowers Parliament to regulate that power by national legislation, but also that Parliament can give you additional powers, and it has done so. Now the question is, how can you then come to the conclusion that your powers come exclusively from the Constitution? I thought that your powers come from the Constitution and national legislation, but notably the Public Protectors Act. The other point is that I think your interpretation of the state may be wider than the Constitution envisages. My reading of the Constitution is that you are not allowed to investigate court decisions, and that is mentioned specifically. But Parliament is not specifically mentioned. But when you read this section as a whole, one would come to the same conclusion as Mrs. Smith, that we are dealing with a radical relationship. If you account to us, you are going to justify yourself to us. It means that your scope cannot include investigating or encroaching on the work of any committee of Parliament. But let me leave that and come to the question of the higher purpose. I think as well your interpretation of the higher purpose may be broader than what the Constitution envisages. I read the Constitution, the higher purpose, to mean a prohibition of arbitrary powers on the part of the great branch of government, which would include both the national, provincial, and local branches of government, excluding the judiciary and parliament, conscience of the state. I thought as well that you have the right to oversee what the branches of the state, of the executive do, and also investigate, but that you don't have the sole right to oversee and invest and investigate. There are other oversight bodies, and therefore one can argue that there has to be some principle of complementarity, meaning that my office cannot wake up and just investigate the whole of government, regardless of whether other bodies with concurrent powers are already doing that. Now, I'm wondering whether you have considered the following. Chairperson, I'm going to end it. I will take the whole thing. I wonder whether you have considered a question where you really have to have to identify sources of areas of investigation. For instance, we have more than 30 portfolio committees that are overseeing government and producing reports. And the reports of those could assist you in identifying and prioritizing things that must be investigated. You have the Auditor General report. I thought they could also assist in that. You have the Department of Evaluation and Monitoring. I thought that could assist. You have corruption watch bodies. Now, the question would be, do you really have to simply listen to all complaints and act, or should we look at other reports, listen to the complaint, and prioritize, because certainly you won't be able to do everything under the sun. And now I want to argue that maybe the lack of that kind of an approach of application of the principle of complementarity and prioritization expands your scope to the extent that you need more money, which would not necessarily be ordinarily be needed if that prioritization had taken place. Lastly, we'll talk about indifference. I think that some of these indifferences in government departments and everywhere also have to do with the problem of culture. You go to different organizations, no culture of work, no work ethics, and so on. Whether those are the type of things that you really can investigate successfully and prevent, because it means we really need a national ethic that must be developed. Without developing that national ethic, you can't solve the problem of indifference. So where do we start? Do we start with indifference or with the development of national ethic, and whose responsibility is that? But I think the area itself may be important, because what could that guide you, for instance? Look at the land case, which is a very serious national question. Land claims instituted in 1995 and 1998, even today, have not been completed. If you try to find out why, it's stories which are not understandable. People will tell you that, no, the communities are not agreeing, they're fighting among themselves. Whereas there is mediation provided for, there is a provision for independence. I thought those were the national, key national things that you could come and use to address this question of indifference. But Chairperson, I'm really just saying that for me, it's unacceptable that 20 years down the line, we don't have a common understanding of the Constitution, especially the mandate of an important body like this, and the scope of its work, and then we're still called upon to have dialogue on what the Constitution means, when we're supposed to be implementing the Constitution. Now, if after that dialogue, we find that we were wrong in our understanding, how are we going to undo the great volume of work that was been done for 20 years? So this is a serious matter. I hope when we come out of this meeting, we'll have that common understanding and put to an end the confusion that the public protect claims exist. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Just following on slightly from previous comments, in your request to Parliament, you say that you want us to assist in failure to, in instances of failure to implement remedial action. But you're not listening to that anyway. Calling us indifference. You talk in your request to Parliament about certain instances of failure to implement remedial action, but the as it is in the Constitution. The Constitution gives you the power to take remedial action, not us. What if we don't agree with your proposed remedial action? How would you suggest we deal with that? My other questions are as follows. The rules you're referring to, are these the same rules we've had for the last few years? And so why has it taken so long to finalize? You're wanting 35,000, I think we can deal with that. If it's 35 million, then I would like to get your comments on the annual report, page 107, which you glossed over rather quickly. Money owing by the constitutional entity was not always paid within 30 days of receiving an invoice statement. The accounting officer did not take reasonable steps to prevent irregular expenditure and fruitless and wasteful expenditure as required by the PFMA. Leadership did not exercise sufficient monitoring to ensure proper planning and implementation of the case management system. Consequently, fruitless and wasteful expenditure was incurred. And most importantly, the leadership of the entity developed a plan to address internal and external audit findings, but adherence to the plan is not monitored on a timely basis. So you come here and tell us that you now have a plan. Well, how do we know you're going to monitor the plan if you didn't before? Can you please give us details as to what your plan is and why we should entrust you with an additional 35 million pounds when you are clearly not just monitoring the money that you have at the moment? As far as your increase in complexity of cases is concerned, I would like to know if you have any idea as to the reason for that. Do you have people coming and telling you why they're coming to you? Do you have any idea as to why you are getting such an increase in complexity of cases and corruption complaints in particular? Now, my question on corruption complaints, I mean, this is a crime, obviously. So what are you doing with those corruption complaints? How far do you take your investigations? And are you referring them to SAPS or the Hawks? And if you are, which I would sincerely hope you are, do you monitor what happens to those cases? Have you got figures for us as to how many cases you think to SAPS or Hawks or SIU or whatever? And what have you done with it? What action have you taken to follow up they have been investigated, and how many have been taken to court, and how many corrections have been obtained? As far as harvest not being achieved, one of the reasons you give is that you don't have enough stock, but surely you knew that right from the start when you set stock. So why did you set those targets so high? You can't come and set targets and assume you'll get more stock during the year if you don't have money for them. So how did that happen? And then just on your number of stock, you seem to be having difficulty with your numbers today, but you said, I think it was 284, and then you said 284,000. I can't imagine you have 284,000 stock. Can you just clarify that, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Public Protector, for the report. A number of the issues have already been raised by my colleagues. I would just like to look again at your six statutory mandate areas in your submission and just ask you in a more positive way. We have engaged with you robustly on the issue of your mandate, but I'd like to just look at the issue of combating corrupt activities act and your mandate in that regard. And I remember you addressing a meeting where you said corruption is reaching the tipping point in our nation. And I'd like to just ask you, and you also send your report, today, growing reports of corruption and tender rigging. It's obviously a concern for all of us, and we've got budgetary constraints, and the SIU a few years ago gave us the indication of 50 billion rand per annum was wasted through corruption. How do you, tying up with previous questions, how do you apply your mandate of shared enforcement of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act? And then, practically, are you still of the view that we're at the tipping point as far as corruption is concerned? Have we got over the tipping point? And that's a concern of all of us. And then I have engaged with the Deputy Public Protector on the issue of whistleblowers, and thank you for the document you sent with that. But are we making progress in protecting whistleblowers? And I seem to think not sufficiently. And what further steps can we take to enhance the protection under the Protected Disclosures Act, whistleblowers obviously being a very important aspect of fighting corruption and the protection of whistleblowers. But there's an interesting clause in the Combating of Corrupt Activities Act that makes it an offence if you as a public servant are aware. You might not be involved in it, but if you are aware of a forensic report and you don't act on it itself, I think there's a monetary amount. Is that being made public at all? That if you don't disclose all your corrupt activities that you might not be involved in, but you are aware of it, surely we should make that also more accessible to the public in the fight against corrupt activities, because clearly we've got severe budgetary constraints as a nation. We're running a fiscal deficit, and if we can inhibit regular wasteful corrupt expenditure, we will be able to balance our books and give Chapter 9 institutions like the SOLS more resources. But something to, you know, that the whole issue of corrupt activities is a big concern, and we'll be raising it with the SIU unit as well. And I firmly held the view that if one increases the capacity of law enforcement agencies, they can recover funds from persons that have stolen them, surely it makes sense to enhance that capacity and resources. And so I appreciate the work that you've done, the good work that you've done as a public protector. I appreciate the fact that you might differ on remedial activities, but I think that it is an issue that one needs to look at the resources at disposal, particularly if you take increase in your workload of now 37,000 cases, that is significant. And can it fairly be expected of you to carry out your mandate if you're not given sufficient resources? And of course then one gets back to the question of where are you allocating those resources. I just also wanted to ask you then, under your lessons learned, which is very useful, and your investigation into systemic failures and the issues relating to, you make a statement that without ending impunity, no difference can be made. Now, that obviously means to me that there are not sufficient prosecutions or people being brought to book for committing maladministration or whatever. We know the deterrent to crime is that people are certainly prosecuted and brought to book. And you also indicate your concern about the application of disciplinary actions. Maybe you can give us an indication of how does one, and are you engaging with the Public Service Commission as to have consistent applications of disciplinary action to combat corruption, nepotism, maladministration? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Public Protector. Maybe before I put my question, I must clarify that the Public Protector should not maybe feel that I'm having on the question I've asked before, that maybe it constituted space, because it relates to Mpumalanga. I'm from Makate, not Mpumalanga. And let me commend you, Public Protector, when you were speaking about the initiative to to have some agreement with the post office as a maybe implementing agent or in partnership with them. My question relates to, you remember I had been asking the public protector to the office at the Siabusa and the like, but satisfactorily you said no. The office also is being closed, but there will be some constant presence of the Office of the Public Protector there. And then, but specifically it relates to a place next to Siabusa, which is Wamsanga. I've noted that you have been visiting hospitals. My question is, was it as a follow-up to patients that were rising from the community or from those hospitals, patients there, or was it proactive from the Office of the Public Protector? Why I'm asking that question is because there is a hospital at Wamsanga. There is an outcry from the community. In fact, one day there was something like 1 hour program on Google FM. The community around there were mourning about the level of the services at that hospital from Sara. But when I was listening, I was hoping that maybe one day I would hear that you have also visited Wamsanga Hospital as one of the hospitals that you have been visiting. One more, it's not time for the security.
Professor Ramanov. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We, as usual, of course, thank the public protector for her exhaustive presentation. Chairperson, I've got three small questions. First one is, which organizations do you use for the training of your personnel? Let's share that with us, please. I think it is important. The second question is, you referred to the growing reports of corruption and tender rigging. What, in your view, is the causation of this phenomenon, which is raising ugly head? Now, would an increase in your budget enable your office to obtain more insight into this phenomenon? This is important because in order to prevent crime, one needs to know the causes or the possible causes of crime. My last question, Jeff. We've heard that the public protector dealing with the Rwanda hospital, were you perhaps by any chance asked to intervene in Makot Hospital in Durban, a very old institution which has been in the news because it has been closed in KwaZulu-Natal? Please share that with us. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I just want to thank the public protector for the good work that she's doing. If I were to mark you, I would give you 80/100. I am impressed. Especially that you have started talking to premiers and councillors and chairpersons of committees, because now you are talking to leadership. I strongly believe, it is my view, that any institution, it doesn't matter how many chartered accountants you can put in that institution, if the leadership is not doing its work, we are not going to get it. So by talking to premiers, I think you are hitting the problem on the head. The question of leadership, public protector, is very important, even in your own office. Because if I was reading the report of the Auditor General, and I was not happy when I read that leadership did not exercise sufficient monitoring to ensure proper planning and implementation of the case management system. Consequently, fruitless and wasteful expenditure was incurred. It's a question of leadership. We cannot say this manager did not do what. You must take that responsibility yourself. By the way, as a committee of parliament, our job is to hold the leadership
the executive account in this case, it is your friend. It is not your friend. So I want to say that in the future, I would like you to take charge of what is happening in your office and not relegate it to your staff. The other thing that I did not like is on the financial performance management, non-compliance with Treasury Regulation 16A 9.1 could have been prevented. That is what the auditor is saying. Had compliance been properly reviewed and monitored. You see, your office is dealing with checking compliance with laws in the under. So it should not be said about your own office that you did not actually comply with a laws of this country. The other one that is that 30,000 compliance. So I was reading what is it that you are going to do, a management action plan. You read here the management action plan is you are going to provide training to officials, implementing supply chain management system, review and monitor compliance. This will be done by relevant management level. It's all right, but what I want in financial matters is consequence for wrongdoing. I did not hear it here. There must be consequence for wrongdoing in the country. We cannot just keep on telling people that we are going to train them. 20 years down the line, we're still training. People must have consequence for doing things wrongly. Your request for more money. I honestly think that some of the things, let's say for some of the cases that you are taking, maybe those which could be done by the Inspector General, I think she should have enough funds for doing that. But if you take it yourself, you would obviously be using your resources, which were not earmarked for that by the Constitution. Thank you.
Public Protector, your office have wasted 13 million rands with regard to your case management system. It's a lot of money. Can you tell us whether you have been able to get any of that money back? What was the source and responsibility of that waste? Can you also indicate to us when we will get the provisional report of the Nkandla issue? Because that's been outstanding for so long, and every time she's on TV saying soon, 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 when will that come? With regards, there's been a lot of discussions about your powers and where you derive that from the Constitution and statutes, but please do also keep in mind that the interpretation of it has also been set out by the Supreme Court of Appeal in a matter where you were one of the litigants, Public Protector versus the Marina Guardian, and that court case sets out clearly for any layperson what your powers, how broad it is, and how far you can go. But I also want to ask you, there's been a lot of newspaper reports and outstanding issues with regards to your own administration within your office. Can you give us an idea as to what is the role and powers of the Deputy Public Protector versus yours? And whether there is any beef between the two of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. And thank you to the Honourable Members for the question and for the kind feedback from some of the members. First, I will start with the last question, which is basically the essence in the room. Let me just hear that one again. The 13,000 expenditure honorable members. Thank you, Chairman. Seems like today my brain is running away from the millions and thinking I'm going to the thousands. But thank you, honorable chairman. Thank you. The 13 million is the case management system that was purchased in 2008. You will recall that I indicated to this house that I was appointed in September 2009. You will recall, honorable members, that for the first 3 years of my existence in this office, there's been engagement on the case management system. What's going on with the case management system? Can it be fixed? That is the case that we now reach the point where the Auditor General decided to impair it and to make a finding that it was fruitless and missing for its image from the beginning. When there is an allegation or a finding by the Auditor General that there was poor planning, that is the poor planning that happened between 2007 and 2009. At that stage, I was not public professor, That's the case management. We are now in a position where we are looking at replacing it. It's been a lengthy journey. Basically, the information we got from the auditors, we paid the Auditor General to audit the system, not as Auditor General initially, as experts. We got the team from the Auditor General, IT, to audit the system to look at, was this system ever brought to display? Was it ever a case management system? Their finding is that it never was a case management system, it was a data management system, and then was fault in signing off. That's talking to the investigators, because a case management system, simply speaking, is a system that monitors a case from the moment it comes into to the moment it exits the system. If I'm sitting here in Cape Town and one of you asks me about a particular case, I should be able to go into our system and then check the case and tell you that that case, we received it on such and such a date, it was allocated, investigators and so, this is what has happened on it. It was never able to do that before my arrival. I arrived 1 year into it being implemented. But then there was lots of noise when I started. When investigators, every meeting we attended, they were just complaining about our system. We have now, with the assistance, initially the Auditor General evaluated. Then we asked ours, because they also have a massive system that involves case management, to look at it. Then we asked SEP. SEP is the company that installed the system, or that sells the system but did not install it. They said we chose a wrong, what do you call it, implementing partner. The people, the woman or the agency that was given the tender to implement the system did not have the right capacity. So it's not SEP's problem. SEP is a good company, it's international. The system was fine, but the implementation of it was messed up. Then why now the whole amount has been impaired? It's because they're saying it was the system was inadequate from square one. That's why they decided to impair. I'm not an auditor. I wouldn't have impaired it because it did serve as a data capture. It never was a case management system, but it did capture data. So I would have maybe given it credit for having done some of the work. But that was not my decision, it was the Auditor General's decision. From our side, then, we're now in a process where we've secured a process engineer in with the assistance of SARS to execute our business processes. And the tender has been issued. It's in the process. We're hoping that by the 1st of April, not we're hoping, we're planning that, by the 1st of April, we have a proper case management system. Something similar to what you find if you go to the CMA. We have a case management system that has been functional since the 90s. If you go to any ombudsman offices, we visited UK, they were functioning when we visited Singapore, and they have functional ombudsman. That's part I thought I needed to just clarify to honorable members about that system. Attempts to rehabilitate the system have not worked. That's why then eventually they did not make such a decision to incur into a one. it's infection. And Honourable Smart, let me just start by saying thank you for those comments. Regarding the issue of accountability, Honourable Smart, that is not a debate. That's a given. This office, the Auditor General, Chapter 9, Chapter 10, Chapter 11, we are accountable to Parliament. When I quoted the UK, it was for a different reason. But let's just start up with the issue of tax missing, not due to less resources. It is, now, it is, the Auditor General, they wanted an explanation, Honourable Smart, as to what is the Auditor General. The Auditor General is saying what Honourable I think it was Honourable Smart. Who asked us? Who asked, I think it was Honourable Schaefer, actually, who said we knew when we planned but we did not have resources. So why did we not cut, as one member of the committee said to us previously, why did we not cut our future according to our code? And it's a really difficult question for me because I engage this committee in Islam and we have been. The Auditor General would behave with us just moving the deadline. That's what they had advised. When they were saying that the strategy didn't plan properly, that's all they talked about. It's been a going forward and going to the committee. In fact, my team is saying the Auditor General said shit the timelines. Why are you insisting on the timelines? I'm not very sure. I understand that I can't ask somebody who's handling 100 files, for example, to complete investigations within a year. I'm not able to ask somebody at GGI, we have 50 files to complete each investigation in a year. So it is very difficult to do that. We have now agreed to negotiate with the union. We have also agreed to integrate this thing in this business process thing, to then say, once we have that business process engineer that is going to be procured by us all on loan from FAS, we will have to then maybe make that difficult decision than to say, on average, a normal investigation should take 2 years and an early reservation should take 1 year. Which in other countries, early reservation, we were in Holland not so long ago, early reservation is 1 month and normal investigation is 6 months. That is Honourable Smart. I do understand, I think it's not the first time that they have engaged with us. I must take responsibility, as Honourable Chopin said, and the data, and besides here, I did overrule my team. So maybe I have to it's really difficult because people though have different expectations. You could change the targets and meet what the Auditor General think we should do. Any reasonable people would do is that you cut your flute according to four. But people still expect honestly that if it's an investigation meetup, it shouldn't sit with us for more than 3 months. And if a normal investigation, it shouldn't sit for more than a day. The Honourable Adams right now, not Adams right now, asked us about income. That's the one of the fastest ones then. Because we're not a year, well, we're 2 years, you know. If you look at the original time, it was reported with us, but in terms of actual time when we started investigating, it had moved faster than others. Again, people out there complain that moving faster on the ones where the media is watching us, or where the politicians are watching us, and their own personal cases. They're always just trying to balance everything to make sure that everything is moving. But that means that this is pace. The wider the breadth of investigations, the investigator, the more difficult it is to move fast. So, and then Honourable Schaefer, what we put in the UK, and I've already indicated, and some of us are smart, it's not you. It was not about accountability. I was just, there were two reasons I put it out. So the main one is not the one you picked up, but the one you picked up was picked up by someone in my office when I indicated I would include the slide. So I just included it was nostalgic about how we started and where we are. And today was going to be exactly 4 years down the line for me, and she was appearing for the first time. However, on issues of accountability, the Public Protector Act specifies, you quoted Section 9.2, and Section 9.2 was something we were going to discuss, because Section 9.2 is provided for me. It is concerned for the Public Protector. No, but I'm saying Section 9 is about contempt. No, behaving. The whole of Section 9 is a contempt provision. Section 9 is contempt. 9.2 is part of Section 9. Okay. I guess this one then we have to go to the interpretation of sections, whatever name is, because this is a section. Section 9, the heading of Section 9 of this Act is content. But can I proceed then and indicate where I was going to say? Because I started by saying I fully agree with you. My understanding is that Section 9 is a contempt, and then obviously it indicates that it wouldn't be contemptuous if somebody discussed something like this. And for me, that's a given, because this was about contempt. Ordinarily, if a court is engaging in a matter and you start discussing it, the court can slap you with a contempt on the public. I have the power to slap anyone with a contempt on the public. Anyone who treat me with contempt. I have the power, there are no exclusions. But this then makes a very clear exclusion around you can't, it is not contempt if Parliament happens to discuss the same matter that I'm involved in. Can I then come to talk to how, because that's just a discussion, I'm not talking about now accountability. My understanding, Honourable Smart, do you have a copy of the Act? Is that Section 9 is a contempt provision, and then of the Public Protector. And then the engagement in Parliament is provided for in Section 8. It's the heading in the Act. I don't know, we have created a small booklet so that we can make available.
People right there. Involved in the writing of the policy. I really don't read the booklet. What is it in 8 that you want to refer us to?
Honourable Chairperson, I would like you to ask Honourable Smart to just let me finish, because we might just end up in the same place if she gives me a time to finish the sentence. I actually think we will have a little bit. May I have your protection?
Fair enough, you have my protection, but I must also protect my amendments, because they are seeing things coming from you that's working on yourself. Workshops about quotations on Britain. It's not as though we came here last week and we found this
interesting. Right. Might I proceed to the Honourable Chairperson?
I promise you will.
I really would appreciate it. And I was referring to Section 8, which says the Public Protector may, subject to the provisions of subsection 3, in the manner he or she deems fit, make known to any person any findings, comma, point of view or recommendations in respect of a matter investigated in the affair. Then, subsection 2 says, the Public Protector shall report in writing on activities of he or her office to the National Assembly at least once every year, provided that any report shall also be tabled in the National Council of Provinces. B, the Public Protector shall at any time submit a report to the National Assembly on the findings of a particular investigation. This is my understanding of how then we're supposed to engage on specific cases. It gives you then the following. opportunities for engaging specifically under subsection 2. Any of that subsection 2 says, I will bring the matter to Parliament if I deem it necessary, he or she deems it necessary. From MPPA 2, he or she deems it in the public interest. Subsection 3, it requires the urgent attention of an intervention by the National Assembly. Subsection 4, he or she is requested to do so by the Speaker of the National Assembly. And subsection Romantic 5 says he or she is requested to do so by the Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces. So this is the standard. The Ombudsman is a 204-year institution. Is that put in Sweden 204 years? In the English area, it was initially introduced in New Zealand, and then in Africa it was introduced in Nigeria about 50 years ago. My bringing these kinds of experiences is because we benchmark against each other. We help each other. In fact, when there were issues here in Parliament, I put my colleague in Sweden on the speaker when I engaged with her. I put the Honourable Julie Nella on speaker also, and then now I put my colleague in Poland on. I chaired her as well. Just to talk about what is the situation in her case, our expectations different. It was in that context that I quoted the English thing. There are all these provisions. The first three are how I will bring a matter to your attention if I request a debate on it. The second two are how Parliament will request me to be part of the debate. And that's the standard approach all over the world. I was asked to explain why I brought in the UK experience, and I was indicating that it is not about avoiding accountability, because accountability is a given. It is to give an example of how one country does it in the English world, in the Commonwealth. And that's a Commonwealth experience. It's still accountability, but it's structured more in line with what I see in the Section 8 of our Act. Now, let me go to what is my definition of state of first?
I don't know what we need to do to remedy this, because you see, the law of interpretation says that you must read a document as a whole to understand it. Now, if you cite Section 8 to define how you bring matters to Parliament, and then you don't read that together with Section 9, which says nothing contained in this shall prohibit a discussion in Parliament of a matter being investigated, which is overriding provision. It may suggest that unless you come to us, we have no say over your work. But maybe this is not for discussion now. I'm just saying that I think going forward, let's clarify ourselves on interpretation issues.
May I just start again with Section 8, but I have mentioned the Honourable Motsepe. Now, I just wanted to say that it doesn't say the process should be initiated by me. So, as I indicated right now, I said the first three give me the power to initiate, the last two give Parliament the power to initiate.
Do we want to engage on this?
No.
I think
we also need to make an improvement. So I think the feeling amongst the French members is that this is not the occasion for that. Okay. There's a lot to discuss on your powers. Section 92 is very relevant. The public protector versus the guardian referred to is extremely relevant. And I would refer you to Section 55 of the Constitution as well. so that when we do have this discussion, we understand what we are saying at this point.
Thank you.
I think we can say we don't agree.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Where I can say for me there is agreement is that there is accountability to Parliament. There is no debate about that. The issue is what is the procedure. I think that that's the only difference that we should sort out. My understanding is that the procedure is set out in Section 8, and the procedure is also set out in Section in the Constitution itself, in Section 1815, which talks about voting on activities. That's my understanding, but how we interpret that is something that is for debate. But accountability is not debatable, it's not negotiable. So that's not an issue. And also accountability for Parliament. Obviously, there are different channels of accountability. For example, I have no problem to accounting to the Speaker on certain matters. No, I'm not talking about...
The officer of Parliament, the 400 members of the National Assembly are who you account to. We are an open of those 400 members.
I would like you to finish it, but if we could do so quickly, and move off this
particular. Thank you so much. Right, now let's go to the definition of state affairs. Honourable Mutaka has said that this office has been here for almost 20 years, and we are right there. Today is turning 18. Because it opened its doors for the first time on the 15th of September 1995. On the 15th of October today. So it has opened its doors. The only reason, Honourable Mr. that I've asked that we should engage on this is that I worked with this control committee since 2009. There were no issues about what is my mandate. I stepped into the shoes of two public protectors who each finished 7-year terms each. Being executive and things that I do. And then I stepped in. We started last year having these conversations about what exactly are my powers. And then my view was, having seen the Auditor General and the Public Accounts Committee working as a family, I then thought that perhaps if we were to sit around the table in a non-reporting environment, in a discussion, we could get into the issues around it. Because the mandate hasn't changed. Advocate Bagwa operated. He was investigating all state affairs. He was investigating the three branches of government. He was investigating in the three branches of government. He was investigating at three levels of government. It was never an issue. The members of parliament sitting around the table, they bring letters to me on issues that are present in court. And you are right, Honourable Mutaka, when you're saying I'm prohibited from investigating after a court has made a decision. But the Public Protector Act has even widened the exclusion beyond just not investigating decisions of courts. It has widened the exclusion to not investigating judicial matters. And this office is always respected. This office has always accepted that it has never transgressed anything. Since Advocate Bagwa, decisions delayed reports were investigated. They are still investigated today. Problems with the maintenance report, problem with the master's decision. They were investigated by Advocate Bagwa, they were investigated by Advocate Mutwana. They are investigated. In April, we started talking about should I be dealing with labor matters, should I not be dealing with labor matters. Again, there are written reports from my predecessors on the same matter. That graph that I presented in April that shows the usual offenders, for lack of a better word, is a graph that comes from previous reports. And just don't have the time right now, but if we were able to Google randomly a report of Advocate and put it on the screen up there, you will see that
the mandate hasn't changed. The investigations of Chapter 9 institutions, this is the first time I am hearing that they are excluded from my mandate. This parliament referred the CGE investigation. Two joint committees referred the CGE investigation before I became public protector. I came and concluded the second investigation. The Auditor General audits all of us. He is a Chapter 9 institution. His power extends to all of us. It's the first time today that I'm learning that there are things. So I'm finding that as the years go by, there are questions around the birth of the mandate. So I just then thought we need to just sit down and calmly and go back, because these things are documented. You know, the work of Sally Bagot, he issued another report. The work of Advocate Mokot Moshona, he issued another report. There is nothing new that we have done. So my understanding of State Affairs, with due respect, is that it doesn't exclude Parliament when it acts administratively. In the same way that the Auditor General audits this Parliament, if there's a request that I should investigate my administration by an organ of the Parliament, I understand that I have the power to do so. In fact, incidentally, I wrote one request last week. I declined to investigate, not because I thought the Parliament was outside my jurisdiction. My letter to the Speaker just simply indicates that I am not, and the complainant has not given me sufficient information to follow it through. Because we assess, the assessment team assesses it and says, is there anything tangible, a case to answer? And it was said that there's maladministration in Parliament's language section. So I wrote back to the... I sent, obviously, the request to investigate to the Speaker. I said, I've been asked to investigate. These are the key issues I've been asked to investigate. But the complainant is anonymous and has not given us documentary information. Therefore, it's difficult to follow it through. But kindly please follow it through. And then I sent it to the Speaker and it was there. But it's because of the jurisdiction. Again, I would ask us to calmly look back and say, have my predecessors investigated allegations of maladministration in Parliament? Have they investigated allegations of maladministration in fellow Chapter 9 institutions? As I said, the CGE one was referred by this Parliament before I became public protector. I just came in and concluded that and we are investigated, or we are audited by the Auditor General who's a Chapter 9 institution. And of course, when the red card is out, sometimes we are not particularly happy, but it is power that is given to him by the institution to do so. So we do that. That is the only reason that I have been. About is the Speaker the boss of Parliament? Honourable members, it really is not my place to. I've never said that it would not be my place to even decide how Parliament is structured. So I choose not to comment on that. Personally, because administratively I do not account to the executive, I have found that we account to the Speaker. For example, if I'm going to the regulation says if I need to go on leave, it doesn't say I can ask the Speaker, but I should inform the Speaker. The regulation says I must inform the Speaker. And two, if I need to take a sabbatical, which I'm entitled to now that I've said 4 years, I must request the Speaker. The other thing that I added on my own was we didn't tell anyone when we were leaving the country. I just did, since I became a protester, I report to the Speaker that I'm going to be leaving the country, and I inform justice as well. That was my understanding, that administratively we account to the Speaker because of leave, etc. If there's an understanding in this Parliament, because administratively you can't account to a committee. There has to be a point of administration or somebody who signs the leave for home. At the moment, it's being signed by the Speaker. Then the Kala Asmar Commission spoke about us having to report to the old collector and report to Parliament. Then the Office in Support of Institutions for Democracy was created. My understanding was that administratively we would work with that. but I'm not really au fait with parliamentary politics, so I would like to try contacting paper first. I've indicated that it's the first time I hear that it excludes fellow Catalan institutions. In fact, when
no,
some...
No, that is a question. That is a question. You have no idea of what state affairs constitutes in a legal institution.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that, Honourable Smart. My understanding is Peter Fraser is the state in its entirety. His conduct within the state, and in terms of the bank protector, it then also talks to what institution can I investigate. It says it should be organ of state as defined in the FMA. So everything that is an organ of state so far, we have used that as a basis of investigation. But I can just do the write-up maybe later today to just indicate, because we use that in any event for asking the assessment team to decide who to investigate. They've got to say, are you within state affairs? And so we've had to do that. But even if you're in state affairs, should I use my discretion? So, but my understanding is that, and then when issues, incidentally, the issue now with Judge Mukwege, that is in the media, it was a threat to me. When it was a threat to me, I went to the Chief Justice and indicated that my understanding is that we do not investigate judicial, what we call judicial matters. And then I requested the Chief Justice just to note that the request has been made, but we were not going to investigate. I'm still interested in what put me to say, but what have I done? The chairperson said last time I should speak to what have I not done. I thought only it would be either to speak to what have I done that has never been done that violates the exclusion. Because from what I know, I haven't done anything that violates that exclusion.
I think the public protector should not feel that she's under investigation. The issues we are raising are not about her person. These are issues of interpretation. We are saying there's no consensus on how we have been interpreting that. And that's why also it would not be correct to say because the Papa or Mishwani did this, therefore it's correct to continue. So we are not attacking you as a person. We are saying there's something wrong with the interpretation of the Constitution and the law and the application. So I'm just appealing that we're not directing this. Not a person.
Thank you, Honorable Minister. Thank you. I'm now getting into your questions where I agree with you that ideally 20 years into democracy and 18 years into the existence of this office, we should not be worried, we should not be still asking ourselves what exactly are its powers. We should be worried about is it effective. That's one of the reasons, Honorable, what I went back to the environment and said when I came, this committee was concerned about certain things. Access, ADR, impact, independence. And I tried to the best of my ability to honor my promise in terms of those things. On the issues of jurisdiction, as you correctly point out, I have understood the Constitution the way I just explained. What I was trying to say there was also that I have not deviated from my citizen. And if anyone has evidence to the contrary, I would be happy to do that. And I have now answered the meaning of state affairs. And then the issue of higher purpose. The higher purpose thing, that is a different angle that you're taking about, are we the conscious of the state or are we the conscious of the people? Let me firstly start with the part about we're not the only ones. I think we're conscious of that, Honorable Mugaka. That's why we didn't think we are the conscience of the state. Because that would be, as I say, that would be making ourselves the superior paragon of what's right and so that. We think we are a conscience of the state, meaning I mean among many other consciences. And you said, why did we say we're the conscience of the state as opposed to the conscience of the people? It's because the characters, I think the way the team defined it, and I've indicated that I didn't define it in many of the higher people's things at the beginning and the end, was that we are looking at who are we supposed to assist to do the right thing. it was the same. The Ombudsman was introduced by the King of Sweden about 204 years ago. After seeing that there were loopholes in what we call the trias political, it was not handling the way things were falling through the cracks. And the King of Sweden decided to introduce this officer that he calls the Ombudsman. And the Ombudsman was supposed to be a buffer between the state and citizens in instances where there was a feeling that the communication between the state and its people was broken, but on administrative matters. Of course, each Ombudsman has its own powers. For example, my colleague in Sweden can review decisions of churches, but he's not one, he's a whole board. So each country then has developed the institution as it deems fit. That's part of what will be discussed with you in the summit in December around how this institution has mutated. Is it ending then as it was conceived in Sweden, not within 4 years, and what could be done to make sure that it gets there. It was always supposed to be the common person. It was supposed to make sure that the common person does not have to go to court if they want to render the state accountable on administrative violations against him. That was the context in which the team then spoke about the conscience of the state. If you look at our vision, we talk about the right administrative wrongs of the state. And this is sort of in line with that. We haven't really finalized it. It hasn't gone to ESCO, the committee, but I just brought it here to indicate this is what the public protector team has recommended to us. And if there are any thoughts, we will welcome those thoughts before ESCO finalizes. It just is supposed to make us focused in such a way that our work is not administrative, it's meaningful. But when we finish with the case, we ask ourselves, what really was it all about? Have we made sure that the state operates with integrity? Have we made sure that government is not just fair to the person we've dealt with today, but we have assisted government to learn a lesson to be fair to the next person that government is going to do it? When you say second something, you don't substitute it. You're absolutely right. And there I would link your comments with the comments of Honorable Shopin, that we try our best not to be a substitute to the state, because that is, we are supposed to strengthen constitutional democracy. That's why we say when we met with the Kenyans and the mayors, we said we don't want to take your problems to Pretoria, we want to leave them here with you, because you're the ones who have been voted into office to deal with this issue. The Ombudsman is supposed to be somebody who is who highlights blind spots of government and gives them back to government to fix them. But ideally, the idea is that you then step out and government functions. When we do systemic investigations, we try to assist in that review. Are we getting assistance from government? We are getting assistance in that there is cooperation from various organs of state that we deal with. And the stakeholder consultations have opened more channels for assistance. We have met with premiers, they've made undertakings to expedite the communication from their organs of state, and we've had absolutely wonderful cooperation from those cases where the premier has stepped in. And I can give examples that we hardly have problems in cases like, for example, the Western Cape, the KwaZulu-Natal, the premier, we signed in agreement there. And a lot of other premiers have come in, Mpumalanga has come in, stepped in to enforce premier action in this system. Accountable to Parliament? Yes, we are accountable to Parliament. It's never been a debate whether we're accountable or not. It's always been what are the channels that have been created by the Constitution and the law on how we should account to them. And you said that we're on wiser than the state as you understand it. I tend to be corrected. Honorable Agent said we must remember the Mail and Guardian case. for us, we regard that case as a touchstone. Whenever we hold ourselves to a test, we try to remember that particular case on what it expects from us. And even its definition of state affairs, it was talking about following the money right up to wherever it has gone to. And because of that, we have gone and followed the money because of that case. And the relationship being hierarchical, that is a given. We have no problem with that, and it has never been an issue by anyone. We don't have a sole right to overthink things. And when you answered, you mentioned a principle of complementarity and prioritization. Let me take the principle of complementarity. That is one of the reasons we introduced the Good Governance Week and Good Governance Conference. It was always to bring together all the role players that are involved in oversight so that we can discuss our different roles. We have even come up with a framework for collaboration, because you're right, there is a sense that we need to collaborate. I don't have to do what the SIU is doing. But now that you have asked, it is wrong for government to come and tell me that I shouldn't do an investigation, it would want the SIU to do it. I'm not saying government has done that, but I'm telling this committee that's it wrong, that is unconstitutional. It is also wrong for government to come to me and say, don't do this investigation, the Auditor General must do it. We want the Auditor General to do it. I'm not saying somebody has said that should happen, I'm saying should it ever happen, it is wrong. It is wrong for a minister to ask another minister to try and stop the investigation that I'm doing, or the NPA is doing, and saying because both of us are investigating, because the NPA does not investigate. But the other thing I'd like us to discuss with this committee, I'm not making a complaint, I'm just saying should anyone do that, and I bring them to this committee when the time arises, I would like support from this committee, because I think it is wrong.
Yes, that's what
you want.
Thank you. That is the principle of complementarity. Before we start an investigation from our side, Honorable Mosekha, we try to find out who is dealing with it, but I think we need now to find a way to electronically link to each other. That's what the Commonwealth was trying to help us to do when we started the Good Governance thing, so that we could have a portal where I can click and find out if the TSC is dealing with this, because the drafters of the SIU Act, for example, envisaged that if the SIU were dealing with an investigation, I would not start it, because it said the SIU should inform me whenever it had received a proclamation. I wouldn't want to think that it's the expectation that I wouldn't then start an investigation. I would expect the same that once I'm halfway through an investigation, two beds down or almost finished, nobody else should be then asked to investigate. But it's something that we can discuss. We're constantly discussing with our colleagues. The NPA will have started for the negotiation and the investigations that the NPA brought to my side, with the understanding that I can proceed with the maladministration investigation and finding, and then we can say go to the NPA. What you suggested about taking into account what's happening in committees and investigating, but I think it's an excellent suggestion. It's similar to the suggestion the Auditor General spoke about when we talked about strengthening synergies, that we should look at what have been his findings, if there's a need for us to take it through. It's something we haven't perfected, but it is an excellent suggestion. It wouldn't those things stop us from helping people on the street, because those that are on the street often come with life issues, like the case I spoke about, the lady we needed to step in and make sure that the salary is attended to, because she doesn't have the salary. Thank you for your comments on indifference. Yes.
That's all right. There may be a second round.